to give us a perspective from the local dental program. Dr. Aloukian.
Good morning. My name is Myron Aloukian, and I'm going to be talking about how health care reform is going to affect programs on the local level. I was the dental director for the city of Boston for 34 years. I've been involved in dental public health for over 40 years. If I have a conflicts of interest, I guess my major interest has always been, as a public health dentist, the population that I'm serving and what's in their best interest. The conflict may arise is that I'm also a life member of the American Dental Society Association, and I'm also a life member of the Mass Dental Society. So I have had internal conflicts in my public health hat and as a member of organized dentistry. And one of the things I've always tried to do in my role is take those things that organized dentistry does that is in the public's best interest, i.e. prevention, finding ways to improve access and work with them in those ways. And where we had a difference of opinions, I always made it a point to stand my ground, because it wasn't me versus them. It was the community and the vulnerable populations that I serve versus their own needs, concerns, and interests. Also, as president of the American Association for Community Dental Programs, we represent dental programs on a local city and county level and community-oriented dental programs. There are approximately 2,900 local health departments in the United States, and we do what we can to provide expertise to the dental programs in those communities. And as Tip O'Neill used to say, the former Speaker of the House many years ago, all politics is local. And local dental public health is where the rubber meets the road. We're the ones who get the calls from the patients in pain. We're the ones who get the calls from the city councilors, the mayor, and we're the ones who try as much as we can to work with the state health department, which is usually in another city, though in Boston, the nice thing is we're both in the same town, so it's easier to communicate. But in many states across the country, the local dental program is much larger than what the state dental program has. When I was the dental program director for the city of Boston, we had over 130 personnel. And at one time, the local dental state dental director was a part-time dentist. That has changed. The program's come a long way since then. But I just want you to know what the differences may be between a state dental program, which often gets money and funnels the money down to the local community. And on the local level, we get what we can from the state, we get what we can from the feds, we get what we can from whoever we can get money from, so we can serve the needs of the public. Just one quick commercial. The American Association for Community Dental Programs does an all-day program the day before the National Oral Health Conference. That's Sunday, April 10. In Pittsburgh. Our program will be on access and workforce. As you know, we did the first panel on the dental therapist many years ago, when some people said it's old news, and it was anything but old news, and we will continue to do some very exciting panels. On the Saturday before, for the first time, we're doing a couple of hours on mobile and portable dental programs, and we'll be bringing in the best people in the country to talk about those things. One other potential conflict of interest, this is the best part of my presentation, is the opening. This is for the students. I'm also the new treasurer of the Northeast Regional Board of Dental Examiners. So if any of you are planning to take the NERB exam for licensure, we serve about 35 or 38 states. I'm not able to say anything about the exam, but I can give you some ideas as to how to study for it. It was Eve that said to Adam, many, many years ago, we live in times of change. And nothing could be more accurate than what has happened in the last few weeks here in the United States with the recent election, and what is going to be happening from this point on. When health care reform was passed, it was very exciting, and we all saw a great future. And it was a major step. It was a gigantic step in terms of improving access to health care. But once it passed, there were the naysayers. And they have, you know, they, before it passed, they talked about death panels. They talked about, you know, government is going to take away your Medicare from you, even though it's a government program. It's going to interfere. And they tried a number of scare tactics to convince the American people that it's a negative thing. The same thing happened in the 60s. When Medicare and Medicaid was being considered, the same things were being said. And in those days, the AMA was much more powerful than it is today. But they were taking physicians who were out on the golf course, calling them to contact their state, their senator, U.S. senator, or congressman. They did an enormous lobbying. The southern states lobbied enormously against it, and it passed. And then after it passed, there was a lot of lobbying and saying it's going to ruin the healthcare system. Now, what many people didn't understand, but President Johnson understood, is that when Medicare and Medicaid passed, that means that the hospitals in the South that used to discriminate against blacks and whites could no longer do it. So you had this very conservative lobbying movement fighting before and after to gut Medicare and Medicaid. And fortunately, we had a president at that time who was very savvy, you know, who was the Senate Majority Leader, and he withstood that pressure. And he was a Southerner, he was from Texas. And Texas is one of the most conservative states in dentistry, along with Mississippi and Florida and a couple of others in the ADA House of Delegates. If you want to see people living in the Stone Age, go to a reference committee hearing at the ADA on access to workforce, and you will think that they are living in a different age than what we're living in today. But there was a lot of pressure before, and there was a lot of pressure after. And there's no question that Medicare made a huge difference for seniors in this country. You talk to any senior today about cutting or doing anything about Medicare, it's the third rail of politics. George Bush tried to do it, and he got killed. And it's a solid program. And that's what I think is going to happen with health care reform that has passed, if we can get through this next year or two. The problem is the Republicans now have the House. Things have been authorized, but many things haven't been appropriated. I'm going to talk about a few things that have not been mentioned by the previous speakers, just touched upon to show you what can happen on the local level. Probably the biggest thing that has not been mentioned is the expansion of community health centers. $11 billion to go to community health centers. Now, just so you know, in the year 2009, of the 1,131 community health centers that reported to HRSA, there were approximately 18.7 million patients. Let's call it 19 million patients went to over 1,000 community health centers in the United States. 18% of that was dental, which is almost 3.5 million patients, which translates to about 8.5 million dental patient visits. Now, that $11 billion is to expand the safety net, almost double the community health center safety net. That's an enormous expansion. Now, someone could say, well, the Republicans are in the House, it's dead. Well, the reality is, the money, some of the money has already been going out. And the reality is that under the Bush administration, the one thing they supported and put money into was community health centers. So I find it difficult to believe that a Republican House would cut community health center funding. I would find that hard to believe. What they may do is look for that money from somewhere else, but I find it very hard to believe. And on the local level, community health centers are the safety net. When I get calls from different parts of the state, I can't find a dentist, I'm on Medicaid, I've got HIV, no one will treat me, I can always send them to a community health center. I know they'll get a quality service and they'll be treated well. The problem is, you can only handle so many patient visits that the private sector is unwilling to take. and that is an ongoing challenge, and I'll give you a couple of examples of that a little bit later. Another area where there's going to be new money, and I'm not sure it will be cut back, and Teresa mentioned it, and Jack, is in school-based health centers. Access and workforce are going to be the buzzwords for the next 4 or 5 years. We're adding 30 million uninsured people who are going to be covered by medical insurance. Now, if I've been medically uninsured for 5, 10, or 12 years, and all of a sudden I have medical insurance, I'm going to be going to a physician. Now that I'm getting medical care, I'm going to say, gee, you know, I've never been able to afford dental care, so now I'm going to try and get some dental care. And my expectation is that there's going to be an increased demand for dental services by these 30 million uninsured. We're talking mostly adults here. We've got about 48 million uninsured in the United States. And in Massachusetts, which was the first state to have a universal health insurance program in 2006, we went from 15% uninsured to 2.5% uninsured. And the program went much better than anyone expected. The administration's always working very, very hard to keep on top of the demand, because the demand was greater than they expected. More people signed up more quickly than they thought. And healthcare reform, much of it was fashioned about what happened in Massachusetts in terms of how to structure it, how to fund it, et cetera, et cetera. And we in Massachusetts are very happy about that. I have got 6 kids. They're all college graduates. It used to be, before we had universal health insurance in Massachusetts, and it's also going to be true now for healthcare reform, when they graduated college, they were uninsured. And because I had so many kids in school, we couldn't pay for their insurance. So they were uninsured for 1, 2, or 3. With universal health insurance in Massachusetts, my kids have to get health insurance. And if they can't afford it, the state helps them pay for it. They have a low-cost health insurance program for kids in Massachusetts. And that's part of healthcare reform today. I find it hard to believe that the college graduates in the next year or two and the past ones are going to say, we don't want this benefit. And I find it hard to believe that the parents are going to say, we don't want our kids to have this benefit. So with the Republican House, I think, you know, they will cut where they can, but there are some very nice things in healthcare reform I find it hard to believe for them to touch. But if they do touch it, it's because the public doesn't know what's going on. I have often said many times at these meetings, we have the best Congress in the world that money can buy. The health insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry spend more money than any other lobbying groups in the U.S. Congress. When you go to any of the major cities in our country, the largest buildings are the insurance company buildings. There are over 1,300 health insurance companies in the United States. And if we were able to go to a single payer system, which I don't see happening in the near future, but if we went to a single payer system in this country, it's estimated we cut the cost for healthcare anywhere between 15% to 22% because of that red tape bureaucracy. We spend more money than any other country in the world for healthcare. Over $2.5 trillion. About $8,000 per person per year. When you look at health status indicators of our population, and infant mortality is rates are one of them, you know, how many babies die at birth, we are ranked 29th to 30th, even though we spend more money than anyone else in the world. Not only in terms of total dollars, but as a percentage of the total productivity of our country. When I started in this field, healthcare was 5% of the total productivity of our country in terms of cost. Now it's about 16 to 17%. And on a yearly basis, it's increasing 2 to 3 times more than the cost of living. And that's why we need healthcare reform so badly, because we have a crisis-oriented healthcare delivery system we're doing very little on prevention. We spend less than 1% of the health dollar on prevention. Less than 1% of the health dollar goes to prevention. So kids cannot make healthy choices. Parents can't make healthy choices because they're not well informed. We're not doing community-based interventions and community-based preventions. And one of the nice things about healthcare reform is they are developing a Council on Prevention, which is going to be promoting preventive services in the delivery of care. And they are also developing a commission or council to look at cost-effective therapies. Does this work? Does it make a difference? That's what the Republicans call death panels. If I'm getting a surgical procedure that's going to tie me up in the hospital for a week, and there's no data to support that surgical procedure really works, and some guy says, well, it works in my hands, that's not enough for me. That's not enough for me. And that's another nice thing about this health care reform bill. But it's being sold as death panels. It's being sold as they're going to take away your benefits. And that's why health literacy and educating the public is so important, so the public understands what's really going on. Right now, school-based health centers are a way to respond to the access problem. But they're a drop in the bucket right now. And the amount of money going to them, I think, is about $50 million, which isn't much for a national program. But I think that's something that the Republicans would have difficulty defunding or cutting because it relates to school children. There is another provision in the health care reform bill that would increase the amount of money that goes to the Division of Oral Health at CDC, about $10 million. It's a dramatic increase to their budget. And CDC Dental Oral Health Division essentially works with the state dental directors, ASTD. That's not much money, but it's much more money than they ever had. I don't know, again, what's going to happen with the new Congress, but that is money well spent because the CDC Oral Health Division, they have the data, they have the expertise, they're the folks that you can go to for help. The problem is it's very small. The old Division of Dentistry in HRSA had over 300 dental professionals, and that's down to a handful. The Oral Health Division has maybe 20 or 30 people at the most. It's a drop in the bucket from where we used to be. I remember in the 70s, there was a public health dentist in every regional office in this country. And when you needed help, whether you're a state dental director or a local dental director, there was someone you could go. Because from what I see, most state dental directors are overwhelmed. Limited funds, they've got too much to do, and they don't have the staff. And if they don't get federal grants, they're really in trouble. Most states in this country are in a deficit situation. They just don't have the money. And my concern is that dental programs on the state level, mostly Medicaid, because that's where they save the most money, we're going to see more cuts in dental Medicaid. And it wouldn't surprise me if those oral health offices and state health departments get cut, even though they're very small as they are. And again, you need a constituency. You need people supporting them so people understand the importance of that. Just to give you a few numbers in terms of Medicaid cuts, in fiscal year 2010, 13 states cut their dental Medicaid rates. And so far in fiscal year 2011, 7 states have made cuts. In Massachusetts, we essentially eliminated the adult dental Medicaid program within the last few months. But what the legislature did do, and again, it's because of the clout of the health centers, and in Massachusetts, the health centers are probably the most politically astute in the country. They allowed adults under Medicaid in Massachusetts to go to a community health center to get dental care and get reimbursed. Very unusual. The problem is we're overwhelmed already, but they view that as a safety net. And I would imagine that if other states are savvy to that, when those adult Medicaid cuts take place, get your safety net dental providers and get your primary care association to at least let the adults who go to health centers get reimbursed. Because if you have a health center that's treating families, and most of them do, and you get reimbursed for kids, but you don't get reimbursed for adults, you're not going to stay in the black. And then an administrator, community board, will say, we're losing too much money in dental, and they're going to cut dental. So on the local level, it's more important than ever before to do what you can when adult cuts are being concerned, is to make sure that the community health centers continue to see those patients and get served. I could talk about a number of other things, but I think what I'd like to do is open this up for discussion. But let me just tell you what I think is going to happen in the next year or two. I think the major debate in the coming year or two, people are going to try and cut, people are going to try not to cut, et cetera, et cetera. Most states are in a budget deficit situation. But it's all going to be access and workforce. And people are going to say there's no money. So how do you serve the need? You expand the scope of services of existing personnel. I think there are going to be major changes in state practice acts, medical practice acts, and health practice acts in general. I'm on the board of a school of the New England School of Optometry, College of Optometry in Massachusetts. In 1990, only 25 states allowed optometrists to use therapeutic pharmaceutical agents. Now every state, they can do use what we call TPAs. Every state in the country today, except Massachusetts, and we've been working on it for many years, allows optometrists to treat glaucoma. And in dentistry, in the year 2000, only 8 or 9 states allowed hygienists direct access to a patient. 8 or 9 states in the year 2000. Today, it's about 35, 36 states. Enormous change. In the year 2000, not one state paid for a physician to do a fluoride varnish, a topical fluoride, or anything. Today, there are at least 43 or 44 states that allow physicians to do fluoride varnish. And this is going to continue. This is going to continue because when there's no money, people need to get the service. And a license is not a right, it's a privilege. You know, most dentists think, I went to dental school, I'm in this enormous debt. It's a right to have that license. It's a privilege. It's a privilege provided to you by a state, which is made up of a population of local citizens. And it gives you the privilege to provide services, and only you. But if you don't provide that service, then they're going to find someone else to do it. Another problem we're going to have is with the increased numbers on Medicaid, we're not going to have the dental providers to provide those services. And that's going to put even more stress on the access and workforce issue. In Massachusetts, a couple of years ago, in the year 2000, we had a legislative commission look at oral health in Massachusetts, signed by the governor. We had 4 legislators on it, and we had different stakeholders from different parts of dentistry and dental hygiene and some of the vulnerable population groups. And they came out with the report. At that time, we had a part-time state dental director that was a dentist. And we're in an abysmal situation, and it raised everyone's accountability. And for the first time in many years, the state ended up hiring a full-time dental director from a part-time person. The Medicaid program. We got data on the Medicaid program. That program was getting 4,000 calls a month of Medicaid patients trying to get dental care. 4,000 calls a month. The second most requested service was mental health, 700 a month. When the legislature saw that, it raised the accountability of Medicaid. The dental insurance companies had a nice insurance company, raised their credibility. They started getting more involved in terms of improving access, and now they're giving out $7 million a year through their foundation to improve access to oral health. The State Dental Society was doing very little, raised their accountability. And they got a mobile van, and they started saying, we're going to do something about access. And that's how you get things done in this country. You raise people's accountability. And that's also true of congressmen. You know, Massachusetts is a completely blue state. We had some challenges from Tea Party candidates, from key people in our state. And for a while there, I thought we were going to lose some of them. One of them was Barney Frank, chair of the Housing Committee and Finance Committee. And the stuff they were putting out, I said, wow, this is terrible. But he won, and he won because the people in his community knew him. I started off by saying all politics is local. Get to know your state legislators. Get to know your congressmen. Let them know what's going on. Let them know how people are suffering. Let them know how people are suffering. Okay. And then I just want to quote Yogi Berra, who used to say, the future ain't what it used to be. The future ain't what it used to be. And unless we are vigilant, unless we're involved, unless we're educating, unless we're working together, there are very few of us in public health. We need to work together with a single message so we can get what's best for the people we serve. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Myron, for those insights. Well, I think we're all pretty excited about the potential in this legislation to move oral health forward for the United States and for Americans. That, as Jack said, this future is now somewhat clouded by the results of the election and the change in the structure of the Congress, and we will need to remain active in seeking funding to implement some of these programs that the Congress has authorized through the Affordable Care Act. This isn't the first time programs have been authorized, but maybe don't come to fruition and wither on the vine if they never receive appropriations. But I wanted to clarify a little bit. There are pieces of this bill that are dependent on appropriations, and others that the appropriations are already there because it's, you know, like Medicaid is a mandated program. Now, the state may not raise their rates enough that dentists are going to participate, but the funding would be there from the federal government if they try to implement the broader coverage, which would be mandated. The insurance benefit for children up to 21, that's, you know, mandated. It's not really dependent on appropriations. The Community Health Center Fund, the way people have told me they interpret the language is that has already been appropriated in the Affordable Care Act. And there's also a Prevention and Public Health Fund that will fund some programs from CDC that also is more or less already appropriated. In the Senate subcommittee, the appropriations that they passed thus far, there was, as Myron mentioned, an increase for CDC, but that was not through this Prevention and Public Health Fund. They targeted that money for other programs within CDC. So that's an opportunity in the future for us to try to better tap into that. So the programs that are mostly dependent on appropriations are those that they specified that they wanted CDC to do, like funding the 50 state oral health programs, the National Health Education Program, and expanding surveillance, and largely the education programs that Jack talked about. In the Senate subcommittee, they authorized, I believe it was a $17 million increase for the training programs. But again, that's only the Senate subcommittee. It hasn't been passed by the entire Senate, and nothing's been passed by the entire House. So those initial steps may or may not go anywhere. So I think there'll be some additional efforts that we'll need to do on the local, state, and national level to try to get as much actual implementation of this legislation as we can. And with that, I'd like to open it up for questions from the audience. If you want, I can repeat your question, but then I'd like the presenters to come to the mic to respond. Yes?
I think most of us believe that oral health is often neglected from healthcare. And I'm wondering if the panelists have any opinion how so many dental provisions made it into this legislation.
Okay. The question is, historically, oral health has been neglected in health legislation, and yet we had quite a number of provisions in this bill. And is there any insight into how that happened, that those became part of the bill?
Someone suggested, Bert, I think that's true. I'd like to suggest that the educational aspects provisions in the GME was a result, the GME of ADEA. The Title VII was a coalition of the ADA and AAPD and ADEA. So to a large measure, I think some of the credit's got to go to DeMonte Driver. And the renewed and elevated profile that oral health received because of his death. But the dental community, in most cases, in my perspective, worked together on many aspects. Some there was a disagreement on, but in large measure, I think the dental community and the associations worked together in coalition. But I do agree that Bert and his influence was significant.
I would also say,
Myron, you need to use the mic before you do it. I'll also comment that I mean, it's just a gut feeling of mine, but I think I go back to the Surgeon General's report and the call to action, and that we've evolved as a dental community over the last 10 years, and I think we do have a better voice today.
I was going to say something similar. I think the Surgeon General's report was very helpful, but I think what's happened is we've been educating more and more non-dental people to try and do something about it. For example, foundations. I mean, today you have a number of foundations that are primarily concerned about oral health. The Pew, the Kellogg, the Oral Health Foundation in California for years. The California Endowment many years ago started putting money into oral health because people are seeing there's a neglected epidemic. We've had this for years and nothing's been done about it. And the word is out more. I think one other thing that's helpful, I hate to say it, but I think when the ADA opposed the Alaska Dental Therapist program and they went before Congress and they spoke at those hearings, and then the local folks from Alaska talked about these great needs, I think, you know, the more they hear how great those needs are and nothing's being done or very little's being done, they're saying, gee, you know, they might not have fixed it there with the dental therapist bill, but they're saying, gee, someone has to do something about this at some point. So I think we've been increasing a critical amount of knowledge in these legislators and congressmen and to the public in a variety of non-dental groups. And I think that's helping make a difference. I mean, to have school nurses come up and speak at a hearing and say we need dental care where they never did it before is very helpful, as well as social workers, et cetera.
Yes.
My question is for Jack Kresh. Jack, you quoted what you would do if you were a Republican, but I didn't hear what you would do if you were a Democrat. And I would like that in perspective of letting the Bush tax cuts end. When does that happen? How can we effectively tell people that this is a $700 billion additive to clear the deficit? This is more money than people spent on the bailout.
The question was for Jack concerning his perspectives on what the Democratic side may choose as strategies, particularly for extending the Bush tax cuts.
Let me take the first part of that. If I were a Democrat in Congress, I would try to pass funding for as many of the programs that I believed in as possible. I would actually try to pass the appropriations. I would try to pass the omnibus bill because I know the future is dim. I don't think that's going to happen because the 2012 presidential campaign has already begun. And in 2012, I believe that there are 33 Senate seats up and 19 of them are Democrats. And the vibrations are out there. The Tea Party influence is still out there. There's even some talk that a conservative like Orrin Hatch of Utah, who is a very conservative, yet I think pretty respectable politician, might see a challenge from the right. I don't know where that right would come from because Orrin's pretty much over there to begin with. But so I think a lot of Democrats are going to go to this lame duck, and if they're up again, and all the House is up again in 2 years, they're going to be very leery of setting up campaign videos of them voting for more spending. The tax cuts, they've got to do something, obviously. And the president seemed to indicate he was willing to compromise, but we don't know what that means. I did hear that there might be an opportunity or a suggestion that we separate the debate, talk about middle class, extending the middle class cuts where there would be much agreement. And then separate from that, the tax cut for the rich, extend that for a short period of time, 2 or 3 months, and deal with it down the line. Now, whether they do that or not, I don't know. But I think the Democrats are on their heels, and it depends on whether they can put forward an effective fight against these tax cuts.
Jack, how many House seats are up?
Well, they're all up in 2012. 435 or 440.
Okay, any other questions? Yes.
Dr. Guest, the ABA president, he was questioned yesterday about including Medicaid for adults and, you know, the question of dental benefits and Medicare for seniors. And I'm paraphrasing his response, but he said that dentists don't have the respect of legislators. They don't have the respect. Dentists are considered as being aloof. So do you agree with that, disagree with that?
The question...
Not just individual dentists. I'm not a dentist. I wouldn't make a judgment on that.
The question was, we heard yesterday from Dr. Gist of the American Dental Association that he didn't feel the dentists had all that powerful of a voice in Congress, but that they were in favor of expanding Medicaid benefits and Medicare benefits for adults.
Well, Dr. Gist's perspective may be somewhat different than some other people in organized dentistry. I think, as Myron mentioned earlier, I think the organized dentistry took a tremendous hit on the Alaska situation. They lost a lot of credibility. That perdures. They were after that series of hearings, they were basically forbidden to go into any of the Alaska members of Congress office. So they're still suffering from that. I think they're still trying to get back some of their credibility. On some issues, they do have credibility, but I think one of the problems is that organized dentistry is viewed as well, here's my distinction. I want to know whether a dentist is a healthcare provider or a small business entrepreneur. How that question is answered will tell you a lot about the perspective of that individual. The same question can be put, I think, to organized dentistry. And I think in some minds on Capitol Hill, they are viewed more as a self-interested entrepreneur group that are worried more about tax cuts than they are the oral health of America.
Last question. The question is, there'll be some, if there is some funding for improved data collection and surveillance, how that might impact the center that will be looking at cost effectiveness of programs.
We have some good data in some places and not in others. Where we have good data is on prevention, community-based prevention. We have very strong data about community water fluoridation. We have data on school fluoride varnish programs. We could use more data. The data is weak on adults. Would be nice to have that. But I think in terms of where dentistry is with prevention, I think the data and sealants, you know, we have data that shows that with disparities, sealants make a difference. It reduces the disparities. Fluoridation reduces disparities. We have that data. I think in terms of the effectiveness of workforce, we could have better data in terms of the National Health Service Corps. Dental has been a very small part of the National Health Service Corps. Most of the money goes to medicine. And that program could probably be upgraded. You know, when it first started in the 70s, it was very different than how it's funded today. It's mostly loan repayment. But I think if they put more structure into it and had a workforce pipeline, which they really don't, I think they could get more mileage. That's a short answer.
I'm just going to say really quickly that I think it's, we have to be careful about what, how we consider the use of data. Surveillance systems, there's a purpose. And I'm not sure that getting at effectiveness is the purpose of an oral health surveillance system. And so really where we need to see some additional investment, whether it's through this legislation or not, is in evaluation of those measures. Because you can't use BRFSS data or the basic screening survey data to evaluate a program's effectiveness. And so the investment needs to be in a more local level, and I say local, community, state, dental program, whatever you want to say, in effective evaluation of whatever it is that we're trying to affect.
I will say there is that provision in CDC's language to do a caries demonstration, or caries management demonstration program for young populations. And if that got funded, that could lead to some significant better understanding, improved understanding of the effectiveness of approaches. Due to the time, I'm going to end our session now. I thank everyone for the insightful questions and thank the presenters for the excellent presentations. I remind you, if you want the continuing dental education credits, to see David Capelli in the back of the room. And I'd like you to join me in thanking our three presenters.